This video is brought to you by Holocaza. Our tool transforms independent local real estate agents to global real estate agents. Create your own profile for free and get contacted by international investors. Sign up with the link in the description.
Hello and welcome everyone to our 120th session of Holocaza. My name is Michael and today I'm talking to Kurt Uhle from Atlanta, Georgia. Kurt is a globally recognized marketer, operator and speaker. He has built and run businesses from startup to over 500 million annual revenue, assembled teams across six continents, been part of the small team and leading an IPO of 880 million and participated in dozens of acquisitions. He is now VP of marketing of eXp Realty World and is overseeing the growth of it. Kurt, thank you so much for being on the show. I'm very honored to have you on the show. Why don't you introduce yourself to our audience?
Hey, thanks for having me, Mike. I appreciate you inviting me to talk to your audience. So,
Kurt, you have started from very, very, let's say, small, like everyone, and then now you are heading a huge team at eXp Realty. Before jumping into eXp Realty and you tell me about your role there, obviously, it's a real estate podcast. I also would like to give you the chance to convey to the audience your first track record and all your other angles which you have, because you're not only eXp Realty, you have many profiles and very many expertises. So walk us maybe a little bit through your career and also especially through your early stages.
Yeah, happy to. So I started, I think my business life actually when I was 14. I mean, a lot of us did things, you know, odd jobs and chores beforehand. But at 14, I had enough friends that I had been employing since the year before. I was going to be forced to file taxes in the US for payroll taxes. So I had to form two LLCs when I was 14. Wow. So not big, not sexy, sexy companies. One was a lawn care company that we ended up adding on pressure washing as an add-on service. But that ended up doing well enough that when I went to college, I thought I was going to shut it down. And thanks to actually being open to an older gentleman that heard a little bit about how many clients we had, he's like, you can sell that. So I had a nice six-figure exit going off to college, which was pretty nice. But I found that I've always been an operator. And so we'll talk a little bit about that. But from very non-technology companies, I've been very much involved in technology most of my adult life. I've invested in a couple of those. I do work in real estate now, which is technology and not. That's an individual, you know, service transaction, one person with another person helping guide through with technology helping. But I spent probably 15 years in hardcore technology. And so the company I came out of my master's out of university into was called Navtech. And it became Navtech. It's now called Here Technology. And so a lot of people use Google Maps today, but still they're number two compared to this company that's now owned by a big consortium. And so like in Europe, this is back, you know, in 2000 on, if you bought a new car with a car navigation system, there was like an 85 to 90% chance it was our data powering that, our traffic data, our mapping data. In the US, it was pretty much 100%. So we expanded from beyond there. But if you think about all the places that use mapping data, especially from 2000 on, I was in this unique place, almost a management consultant. This gentleman named Saladin Khan took me under his wing. I had this direct boss named Denise. They were great. And I didn't realize what I had at the time. I would walk out of a meeting with Siemens Video that made the car navigation system for Alexis, walk into a meeting with FedEx or UPS Logistics that's using the data to route trucks around the world. And then I would walk out of into the next meeting with my own internal innovation team that literally was helped Microsoft Flight Simulator. It's back on the shelf. We went to Microsoft and said, hey, it costs about $100 million to build Flight Simulator. We think we can save you maybe $40 million. Would you like to have a conversation? Well, that was just 3 hours of a somewhat typical day that I had. And I had no idea at like 22, 23 years old, what I was learning at the time. But I was kind of at that linchpin for 11 industries. So I've stayed in a lot of marketing since then, but I found myself about 6 years ago coming into real estate technology. And so we may talk a little bit about that. Through a little bit of a meandering, I found my way at eXp Realty. So this is my second hypergrowth. I tend to be the called the king of scaling. Some people want to grow companies by 2%, 5%, 20% year over year. I'm like, how do we grow it by 2,000% over the next 2 or 3 years?
When you start something like this, when you're 14, My first question is, which comes across my head, is, do you think it's DNA? Do you think it's a gift? Do you think it is some, what do you think, what sparked this? Do you have any eureka moment where you said, okay, actually, I feel like I'm good at it. I'm passionate. Normally we have this Venn diagram, good, passionate. We can make money with it. Okay. We go down and we just like then get better at it because we're dedicating ourselves to it. Do you have any idea there?
I think it's both in frame, maybe for me. I mean, there is some DNA part of it in that my dad is one of, and all of the men on his side of the family and some of the women on his side, if we look back through history, but my dad did not have to sleep very much. He slept about an hour and a half a night until his third round of cancer. Then he started sleeping much more like a normal person. So that I still need more sleep than him, but I have more hours than a lot of people. So there's a little bit of DNA there.
So wait,
and my dad and a lot of his.
How much do you sleep?
About 3 hours a night.
That's it.
So sometimes and I take a recharge. I take a recharge day, like, maybe a 10 to 12 hour day, sometime between every 3 to 4 weeks when my body feels like it needs it. But other than that, it's about 3 hours a night.
And you're not brain dead either?
No, usually no. I mean, I'm drinking non-caffeinated tea right now. I did enjoy 2 cups of coffee this morning, but no, non-caffeinated tea and whatnot. But a little bit of that is DNA. A lot of my dad's side of the family had been, learned people. So like I did bill my first hours to Bell Labs back in the day and ended up being named Lucent Technologies. It's kind of the Apple or the Google of the day. So they helped actually invent like the initial cell phone network. My dad took me in the office when I was like 9 years old and I solved the problem, a math problem they've been struggling with. And so I remember having a really good Christmas. I don't remember like much else. But I asked them later, I was like, I remember I had just this awesome Christmas. And he was like, oh yeah, like you build like however many hours. And I was like, what do you mean? And he was like, well, we would have paid a consultant for that or staff. And since you solved it, my boss was okay with us just billing you for it. So we just put all that into, a great Christmas for you. So there's a little bit of the DNA, but I have a work ethic that I got from a mom and her family before then that were farmers. I mean, they worked farmland in the States. I remember, I was probably 10 or maybe 11. We're at cottages in Michigan and the northern states. And I mean, it's moonlight. I don't know if it's like midnight or not, but it's late, way too old for an 11-year-old to be awake. And we're raking. And I just remember this conversation where I'm like, Mom, when are we going to be done? And her response was something along the lines of, you don't go to bed when you're tired. You go to bed when we're done. Now she was working with me, which is how I think you teach kids. And so I had some of the DNA from my dad, but I've never seen anybody work as hard as my mom. So I kind of joke, Michael, if you and I get on a treadmill next to each other, only you may run faster than me, but only one of two things is going to happen about who gets off first. Either I'm going to die or you're going to get off before me, even though you may be faster than I am.
What do you think? I mean, let's say, I'm just assuming that you maybe could retire right now. What drives you still?
People. Your comment about being passionate. I think too often people choose to do the almost the hobbies that they're passionate about. They're into design or into conversations or negotiations, so they get into real estate. And I kind of went through those ebbs and flows, but I also find our interests change a lot over times. And so as I had this big change in my early 30s, I realized what I was really passionate about was people. And so there's people in everything. And it's just one of the reasons I tend to be industry agnostic. And I've been successful in so many industries because I've found ways that I can operate that are applicable almost everywhere. But what I'm really excited about are the people that I'm either solving problems for as clients, but more so the people that I work with as well. I show up to work every day because of the people that work on my team. I've mentored people, which is non-paid. I kind of view that. I've coached people, which is usually paying gigs. You can be on a board. People only listen to you, 1 hour a month when you have a board meeting. you're a mentor for someone, maybe you have coffee with them, or, you know, you get a beer once a week or something. But when somebody works with you, that's how you really impact their life. And so when I look back over time, the people that had impacted me the most, I worked with in some capacity. And so that's why I show up to work every day, is because I'm passionate about helping other people. How do I replicate myself? And the best way I can do that is not about giving a keynote speech, even though I love doing those, or talking to people like you on podcasts, but it is working day in and day out with people and then letting them not just like see what I think they could do better, but letting them see what I'm struggling with myself. Cause that's where people tend to grow the most, is hearing, wow, my boss or my leader is having this issue as well. And that allows you to open up a little bit and go, well, this is what I'm struggling with. Sometimes personal, sometimes at work.
Since I'm also a tech founder, obviously, I'm very curious regarding the hypergrowth, your mentality. I mean, on the one hand, you can have a mentality and you just still don't achieve it. On the other hand, you can have a mentality, but you're also successful. Do you have sort of a blueprint where you say, I totally believe in concept A, network effects, concept B, virality, concept C, low customer acquisition, or finding a channel where customer acquisition is cheap? Do you have a certain angle which you think is your hyper growth trigger for the wheel?
Maybe not as systematic as you mentioned, but yes, if I really look at things, some of it, the biggest thing for me is the people that are hired on the team. And too many people hire for culture, whether they're a one or two person entrepreneur that's hiring a new VA, or they're trying to bring in people to a brokerage, or they're a $200 million company. Too many people, they hire for culture, but what they really mean, if you dig in, they're looking for somebody that they want to hang out with at dinner or at the pub or something. When I say I hire for culture, I'm looking for things that I would see in Michael's actions on a daily basis. It's not who you say you are, but I want to hire people that believe in healthy conflict. They would rather, to your point, if I believe strongly A and you believe B, well, I'd much rather have that discussion and we come to agreement early on than 6 months down the line where you've just gone along with me. Like, that's a cultural trait you would see in people's actions. I want people that have an action towards bias. I want to hire people that have strong opinions, but they're willing to hold them loosely. So if you have a problem, that's great. Bring up the problem, but come to us with a strong inclination of what that solution would be. Because that goes into my second bit. One of the reasons I'm so good at scaling is I do two things. I believe in documenting as much as I possibly can. Because whether you're a solo real estate agent or you're running a large team like I am, there's always work that you need to be doing. And there's always work that you're currently doing that you need to hand off soon. The best way to identify, could you hand it off, is can you write a Google Doc that explains all the steps? And do you need to change it tomorrow when you do the same thing? And if you don't, you can probably start to hand that off. And when you teach others to do that, that's important. But the second thing I do in addition to that is kind of goes along with that, like the culture traits. I believe I'm wrong about at least three things in my business today. And I don't know that I'm wrong. I only take maybe 30 seconds to maybe 120 seconds every day. But I intentionally pause to ask myself, what could I be wrong today? And most people don't do that. When you start to ask that question, one, you can scale any company a lot faster, as I found, but you start to get in an opportunity when you hire people like that, when you systematize things that, and you start asking that question, now you start having a kind of a milieu that you're able to identify something you might be wrong at or that you could drastically improve 6 months earlier. So rather than being at the same pace for 6 months, I can figure it out today. And then, well, since we're looking for the next thing, then in 30 days, we find out something else 6 months earlier than we might have after that first 6 months. So now I've gained 11 months from getting to the second or third step. And that's kind of tends to be the approach I come into every team with, every problem, when I take over operations for something new, or I tend to be in marketing a lot of times. If we come and look at things, well, what's working and what's not? The data is going to lead me there. And so it's less of do it exactly this way than if you follow those three things that I talked about, the data will tell you what you need to do next.
the ground truth is always based on data, because you mentioned what is wrong, what is not wrong. And I believe, and I think like the first sentence you mentioned regarding two people, two arguments, how do you have a certain framework? And I'm sorry, I asked for the second time for a framework, but do you have maybe like a logical way of saying, okay, now we go back and we get the data from source XYZ, be it primary research users, be it secondary research, this is the statistics. What do you use there?
I like to agree on the data that we need to be checking up front. And really, too many people, especially those that are trying for hypergrowth, the reason that they fail is because they stop doing something that they should be doing. They stop doing it because they're not seeing the outcomes that they're wanting fast enough. And so, because the problem is they're looking for the outcomes. You're trying to do 200 real estate transactions a year. You're trying to generate 10,000 leads. That's the outcome you want. But if you're managing towards that, you're almost always going to feel like we're not going fast enough, we're not doing things. And if you wait until you're 6 months or 12 months down the line and you go ask your head of marketing, why aren't we generating 10,000 leads? Well, any response that they give, it's going to feel defensive. And so the visionary CEO, the hard driver that's at the top, he or she's going to feel like, well, he's the wrong person to be running my marketing because they're defensive. When instead, early on, you should agree, yes, we're trying to reach these outcomes, but let's agree on the leading indicators that will confirm, are we on the right path? You get scale by building momentum. Most people just want the outcomes. So they track towards the outcomes and they fail because they said they're doing the right thing. You or I would come in, and if we could look at everything with an unbiased viewpoint, you're like, oh my gosh, you're so much further ahead than everybody else. But when you only care about that outcomes, well, like, that's where you should be in 3 years or 5 years. The leading indicators, if you agreed on it early on, you'd be like, wow, we're doing really well, or we're not doing as well as we want, or how do we need to adjust and optimize? And those leading indicators then will tell you, how do you need to guide through? I do a lot of hiking with my wife and my kids. And so I can kind of look to the left and see a mountain peak. But if I'm 10 miles away, if I'm 20 miles away, there's no straight path I'm ever going to see. Heck, if you give me a map, chances are I'm not going to fully stay on that map. But I can guarantee we will get to that mountain peak and we're going to meander and we're going to make decisions as we go forward. And we're going to look up and go, oh, we're way over here. We need to go back that direction. That's what data will do to you. But the whole time until you reach that mountain peak, you go, yeah, but I'm not there yet. I'm not going fast enough. And so the leading indicators, that's the data. I think my system approach, that's what I end up going to look for up front. Now, there is research. Like, I'm really good at enterprise SEO, big level, proprietary, build a technology stack to, in our case, I think we have the largest real estate website in the United States right now. This year alone, I've read over 150 patents from Google, Bing, and others just doing search, and probably another 60 to 70 white papers from them, thanks to my friend Corey and some others in a mastermind, where we're trying to figure out the best way to do that. There's nothing I can go to get just a readout of Google's algorithm, but I guarantee there's about five of us that have done more primary research like that than anybody else in the world.
Makes total sense. You mentioned many very interesting concepts. On the one hand, you have the North Star, you need the leader, you need the visionary CEO taking the path. You talked about momentum. I interpret momentum, and tell me if I'm wrong, input one gives us an output one plus X. So we sort of get something, we get something more. Is that correct? Or
yes, and it should build over time as well. And so it's as you keep doing that, that velocity is going to keep getting stronger and stronger. It may take a long time to get the wheel turning, but as the wheel turns, it's easier to make it go faster and faster.
Perfect. Got it. So you basically understand there are certain patterns, and then you can say you're applying, some people call it the 4-hour work week. Others call it the Dean Allen, I think, the Getting Things Done book. Other people talk about 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. Or my huge favorite is the, I think, Peter Drucker regarding, or Paul Drucker regarding the virtual CEO. Do the things which you're good at and delegate everything else which you don't want to do or which you can get done cheaper. And then you document everything as much as possible and you delegate and you try to extrapolate that with someone, virtual assistant or someone else. Is that my correct interpretation, or did I misunderstand that?
I think that's pretty good. I like all of those books. I mean, there's others that I might add in there as well, but it is systematizing to see what can you hand off. And I might add in the what can only you do. Some cases, what only you can do is be the mad scientist to try other things that you don't want the rest of the team being distracted. I think as people continue to grow, not just a visionary CEO, but at every level, as you become more successful and more wise from being more from doing more things in the past, you have a gut feel. I joke, there's a muscle memory you get from doing push-ups and pushing and doing a bar. There's a muscle memory you get in growth. And so there's some portion of things that I need to do that is not scalable at all to be able to find scale that then I can hand off. And so that's something that I think once somebody, it's not easy to find success or real growth once, but to do it two or three times, now it starts being a very small number of people. And so there's a muscle memory that comes in that. And so there's things, which is also why I like working alongside of people on my teams. We're fully remote, but I spend a lot of time pairing with my teams where I just have open a camera with somebody and I'm talking through what I'm doing and vice versa. Kind of like we might in the office, but they need to hear my thought processes because I may not even be able to fully document. There's a woman that used to be on my team. She just left and she went to another company after a divestiture. Her skill set was documentation. Like you or I could walk through, here's what a real estate transaction looks like. If there was no documentation anywhere and you could just talk to her about like what two transactions look like. And she'd give you a 30-page like SOP for standard operating procedure about all the little steps for it. That people like Mandy are incredible because I can just talk and work through the process and she'll document and come back later to ask me questions. What did you mean here?
Perfect. Hypergrowth with venture funding sounds quite easy. You just put a lot of gas into it and you somehow grow. You have a lot of vanity metrics and everyone is cheering up and everything works until the money is gone. Do you have those experiences with basically, or do you know examples where it didn't work? And do you also have examples maybe totally on the opposite where people didn't have money and still made it happen because they found the flywheel?
Yeah, great question. And companies that reach where I think most people would say, oh, that's hyper growth. I mean, you're talking about companies that are doing billions of dollars a year in revenue. There's almost always funding that takes place to that point. Although when funding happens is another questionable bit. For me, I'm focused much more on how do you get companies to scale and make much more money and make much more profit. And that comes into then, do you raise venture money or not? Way too often, I find that people raise money because they think they have to, or they think that's just the next step, or somebody comes in and tells them to. And what they don't realize is, yeah, you took an angel investment round, or you took a $30 million, maybe you bootstrapped to a certain place, and now you took a $30 million round of investment. Well, guess what? You now have a timeline that you have to work against. And so you know, some people think that there may be vanity metrics, but the investors want their money back. And so they're, unless you're looking at like an Uber or something back in the day, it's not just, hey, they're trying to invest in the one of the 10 companies that's going to be successful. People want to control risk. And so they expect real results. Well, there's nothing wrong with that. And you get a lot of wisdom sometimes from money, but too often I find people end up making unwise decisions because they've raised money. So if somebody's early on, I would generally say, if you can possibly not raise money, you should. So there's, for people that have not started something yet, I would basically tell them, one, they need to save up as much money as they possibly can. and they need to cut their living expenses for them and their founders so that they have as much runway as possible before they take money. And now they have 2 years before, hey, you've raised angel money. You have about 2 years, if that, before you either find profitability or you raise more money to keep going after it. That's a, that kind of gets the place where it's like, hey, you say you've raised money, there's a press release, and everybody congratulates you on Facebook or LinkedIn. And I send you somewhat condolences. And I'm like, wow, have a great weekend because you're going to have the next 2 years of pain. And that can be okay. But now, I mean, after that, it's like, once you find something that's repeatable, now I start looking at, should I raise money or not? You're also in much more control if you found something that's repeatable. And then it's, all right, we know for every $100 we put in, we get $120 out the other side. That's a different place to raise money in. You don't have to give up control of the company. Depends on who you raise money from. If you're raising it from venture, they want a turnover in 5 to 7 years. If you raise money from a family office, they might want money returned, or they may be interested in a cash cow that says, can you just keep growing this? And at some point, we're okay. I have some people that are becoming dear friends of mine that they have a really healthy seven-figure agency right now. And they're questioning, should they raise money? And my advice to them is no. Like, they could easily 50X their business right now in the next couple of years. And I don't think that they should, personally, I don't think that they should raise money. As I get into hearing a little more of their story, I might change my mind, but I'm like, they're not building technology. They're much more than an agency, but it's like, as long as they can be profitable, well, then it's, if they raise money, it's, can you raise it so you can pay it back? Because I want them to find, they don't have the perfect fit yet. And that's what I'm looking for out of them before I'm like, y'all should go forward.
Got it. Makes total sense. You talk actually about the TechCrunch effect. You have this huge PR and then you, everyone is cheering, and then you, the reality hits in and everyone then also comes after you. And maybe, maybe you get bankrupt because you're not fitting the numbers, and then you're not getting, you're either getting a down round or you're not getting another round in financing. For me, I don't want to talk too much about myself here, but it's interesting because I totally agree with your approach. I've been bootstrapping my Halokasa for the past 8 years out of my bedroom. And I think you have to find somehow product channel market fit. You need to have the channel. You need to exactly be able to draw to a potential investor, to everyone, like at night at 3 a.m. when I normally sleep, you don't. The entire sales funnel. You need to know exactly who is the customer, who is everything. And then you just need the money to put gas into the machine. That's what I believe. I know there are a lot of different founders, and I also think there are a lot of founders who are very good at pitching, creating a very interesting pitch deck. They have maybe also a very good network of investors, and then the money is flowing easier. Regarding, I don't know, are you into the topic of those non-sexy companies, which are very interesting? I listen a lot to the one, my First Million podcast. I don't know if you've heard about it. Mm-hmm. And they talk a lot about a scrappy website where they make millions of money and it's just a directory of XYZ, and it's costs them maybe like 2 hours a week, and they log in sometimes and they just collect the money. Do you are you also mentoring people in this space? Are you exposed to those, let's say, off the charts businesses, or is it rather the venture-backed businesses where you're focusing on?
A little of both. So I'm in a personal mastermind with a group of people where some of them would be into businesses like that. Others are in other large public companies, non-competitive, similar to where I am. And I think it's healthy to have both. I tend to try to both spend my time with people and pour into, if I'm mentoring or coaching, people that are looking to scale. They're looking for operations. Because where I have been really successful is finding people that I can learn from, where we're not competitive, But we're still, when you're systematizing things, there's that muscle memory I talked about. I was in a group called CEO Netweavers. They're based here in Atlanta. And so it's around this concept we may talk about called netweaving. So all of us have run a multi-million dollar company, and many of us have run $100 million plus P&L for public companies. And so this one gentleman came in, Kyle Otting, and Kyle had been at a company that basically they helped, he spun it out of a large company. Then now he's actually running another one of these that they do pallets for shipping, like wood pallets for shipping. It's not sexy kind of to your thing, but the numbers are insane. I mean, they were the largest, the one company was the largest in the United States for the longest time. And now he's at a company that I think is number one or number two. The numbers of pallets that they touch and interact with on a daily basis is more than what like any widgets, or I mean, it's more than what Target or Walmart deals with from an inventory perspective. And I'm just like, I've talked to Kyle about problems that they have, and it's in that they've found solutions for. And it's the same problems that I've dealt with at other companies. And so being able to have friends like that, that you can share information back and forth with, one, there's always more to learn, but it also lets you know the problem that you thought was unique to real estate or really unique to marketing or unique to selling cars, it's not unique to you. It's a business operations issue. And once you realize that, well, now you're also not alone. And now you have a whole lot more people you can go to. Because if you're just in your own industry and you think this is the only problem that like I could talk to my competitors, who do you go to for help? No one.
Absolutely. One question about the pallets. Is it one SKU, like one SKU?
Well, it depends. Sometimes some are sold and then they get monies when they're returned, and others are rented as well. So I actually have an ex-sister-in-law who is a lawyer at a company that does more reusable pallets of all places. So I apparently know a lot of people that are into pallets, yeah. And they have these little RFID chips on there that they're able to track when they're going in and out of ports and things. That's also a different business model.
But what I was referring to is like one product, correct? Oh, you yeah. have like, that's, I mean, that's the beauty. You have like zero, basically product. Like the inventory is humongous, but you just like, it's always the same.
It is and it's not. So I also learned a little bit too is you think it's just a wood pallet, but then there's a code on there. And so once it has fertilizer put on it or certain types of chemicals, there might be 5 to 10 different codes depending on the type of chemicals that were put on it. So it was one pallet produced, but depending on how it was used, now if it had fertilizer on it, you can't put vegetables on it next.
Got it. Okay, perfect. I understand. Very, very interesting. You now mentioned the net weaver concept, and I know you're a speaker. You are very engaged in this. You're also offering your services on this one. Allow me to ask you to give us an overview there. What can I understand about this entire concept?
Yeah, I think no matter what country, slightly, sometimes the verbiage is a little bit different, but we all have this concept of networking, meeting other people to try to broaden our network. You know, we think talk about social networks. And it was always difficult for me. I was good at it, but I couldn't put the words on why sometimes I just didn't want to do it. I would go to a conference, I would speak at a conference, and I'm like, I wouldn't want to talk to the line of people that came up afterwards for it. Well, because at some level we've all experienced, you meet somebody and they get your business card and you can almost watch them process and go, Michael can't help me. And they don't like, this has happened once, but usually it's in their mind and they basically throw the business card away. Like, I'm never going to follow up with Michael whatsoever because they've decided you're not worth it to me. Well, not everybody that networks is that way, but some people are. And it's because I think a lot of people approach networking as it's self-serving. When do you go talk to other people in the community and start going to industry events? When you're looking for your next job or your next client. Well, net weaving takes a different approach to that. It's the same almost mechanics, but when I get your card, what I'm looking for is, hey, I'm trying to find out just enough about you, Michael, to say, is there a way that I could help you? Like, maybe there's something we could do business together. Maybe you might be able to actually help me, and that could be self-serving to me. But also, I'm keenly aware of where I'm at now that says sometimes you might be struggling something in your business. And if I just took 12 minutes to make a personal introduction with my friend John Field, that might fundamentally change the inflection point of your business. So is it worthwhile for me to take the 12 minutes? Well, I can't do that for everybody. But NetWeaving says you want to look for those type of opportunities and then do for one or do for a small group what you wish you could do for everyone. Now I'm going through, I give a keynote speech. People come up, they shake my hand. Sometimes they push back, but often they're very thankful for the information I've shared. And I get this whole stack of business cards. And sometimes I'm writing little notes on it. And what I'm looking for is, do I need to follow up? Did I already get enough? And sometimes it's introduction, name. I can do that. And I will set time. Sometimes it's just enough where I make a note that says, I want to set aside just a few minutes for us to talk later, to look for those little opportunities. Because instead of networking, which is very me focused, NetWeaving says, look, I'm looking for the connections and relationships that I already have that might be able to impact you. And when you do that, you end up not just having a great network of people you can call, no matter what country I'm in. You're in Portugal right now. Like, oh, I have a contractor, an agency I work with in Portugal all the time. I love him. And I was like, I mean, I don't know, you know, still a big country. I'm like, I should connect you all. You look for opportunities then that says, how do I weave my connections together? And so that's a very different approach that most people take for networking. Now I'm at the grocery store and I look for opportunities like that.
Makes total sense. I really like it. I listened lately to a podcast about how to become a great networker. And it's funny, they still label it networking, but right. They exactly describe your approach. You're actually the best networker by introducing others, because then basically you're also passively increasing like your reputation, because I mean, you make two people happy and then you're actually grateful for quote because you made the connection. So, and then you are actually becoming a networker. So I believe like NetWeaving should be the default function of networking. Just always looking not for me as an opportunistic person, but like, hey, interesting, how can I reach out to my network? Because then it also increases.
Absolutely. I mean, I think people have done net weaving for years and called it networking. A lot of times you'd step in, and if you learn their leadership style, they're not an authoritarian leader. They're going to be a servant leader, much more of an approach. The term, and I think the only reason I even know what it is I joined this organization that I mentioned earlier. And the gentleman that coined the term net weaving, his name Bob Littell, is based here in Georgia, and actually lent his trademarks to allow the organization to get started, because he was doing exactly what I mentioned. He wrote this book in maybe the early 80s, and he met others that had this personality that were doing networking, but they wouldn't have called it net weaving. And they went, hey, can we start an organization just using that term? And he thankfully went, yes, you can.
You also have a book about that.
I wrote an ebook that's, I do like Bob's book. He's got some great videos on YouTube, but I wrote probably a 60 to 70 page ebook. I wouldn't say modernizing, but using my own description, mentioning Bob very much into it, but giving some examples of it that anybody can get for free.
So then I'm happy to put that in the show notes so that people can directly download or check it out. How about your leadership mentoring sessions, and also all your talks? You're talking a lot, you're a public speaker. Give us an overview there. What is basically your activity?
Yeah, so I mean, I have a full-time day job. I mean, I probably work 60 hours a week because I love what I do, and we're in a very big growth phase right now. But I do spend a lot of time writing. I'm not doing so much coaching right now, but I'm starting to do more keynote speaking because I'm able to impact people in a different way. And so I tend to get brought into sometimes private companies. Sometimes I'm speaking to a portfolio of a private equity group right now or shortly, and or sometimes at big conferences. And people are often, they're struggling to deal with problems like quiet quitting, people coming to work, whether they're in an office or remote, and they're just not working. And so they're trying to struggle that. Or on the other side, a lot of people come to me because I've been called the king of scaling, and they're like, how do I do that? And so what my talks end up being, what a lot of my personal writings are right now, talks much more about, if you really look at how people lead, I end up very much talking people through But the reason you're not growing, it's not because of the people you've hired. It's because you're an authocratic leader. You're a micromanager, whether you like to admit it or not, or you're a fear-based leader. All of that comes unto, I believe there's two choices about being a leader. There's a lot of different leadership styles, but I can either be the authority that says, Michael, I'm going to tell you what to do. You do it the way I tell you to do it. And at some, even if the people are nice, then they would never actually say this. If you don't do it, Michael, the way I told you to, I'm going to fire you. Because at the paycheck, that's what's there. The other side is a servant leadership approach that says, look, we still want to hit our numbers. We still want to reach our outcomes. But I'm acknowledging that the best way to serve my customers and or my team is to actually do that. It's to try to serve them. It's not to tell my team. It's not to tell my customer success team. It's not to tell my product managers exactly what to do. It's to make sure they understand the outcomes that I want, why we want those, and why what I'm asking them to do will impact that. And I say asking because we mentioned earlier, sometimes I'm wrong. And what leaders don't realize and why they come to some of my keynotes is they come in there and they keep saying, look, I've been at successful companies. I keep telling these people what to do. Well, when they tell people what to do, the problem is you've hired really smart people. Well, if you tell them what to do, you have not given them an opportunity to give you a different viewpoint or to say, you think that that's the right way, but have you considered this approach? Or if we change it just a little bit, maybe we get 5% more growth than the way you told me to do it, Michael. And people don't want to hear that usually. I mean, it takes stepping away to a conference and dedicated time to kind of go, maybe that actually is what's holding me back is it's me. So that's where I spend a lot of my time if it's not at the day job, which I love the day job. But my wife and I have found by doing a lot more talk, coming on podcasts with people who have audiences like yours, we're able to just plant little seeds with people that start to multiply ourselves a lot more.
It is very interesting that you say that. Me personally, I think I have rarely worked for someone who has been able to encourage his team or her team to speak up, to challenge in a safe space, saying, hey, because the thing is like, it's so sad. You are in white collar jobs, you are hiring the brains, you want to multiply yourself. You don't want to be limited to your brain, to your point of view. So you want to have someone coming up and say, hey, this is your day, think and come up with good ideas and be productive and work the way you like to work. And we talk at the end of the week or we talk in the evening. And I want you to just challenge me. And I think like it is a very thin line between encouragement, but also making sure that you give them like a certain safe space there.
Yeah. And I don't always get it right. I think that's one of the reasons from a leadership perspective, I try opening up. I mean, I had a call with some of my team earlier today and I started it by just saying, hey, let's just set for a minute. I had a difficult weekend and there's some personal stuff going on and maybe a little bit with work and I'm tense. I can tell it in my chest. So can you give me a little bit more grace? Feel free to call me out if it feels like I'm being too passionate because passion comes across as anger. And nobody had to kind of call that out. Maybe so, because it did help me by just telling them where I was feeling at the moment, but it gave them permission to say, hey, look, anything that may kind of come out isn't you. It could be me, but God, I still don't get it right at times. I mean, I mentioned quiet quitting. The other side is, I wouldn't say it's worse, but it's at least as bad as quiet quitting. You keep asking your team, this is what I need you to do. You've explained the outcomes you want and it's not happening. Well, that's a problem. I mean, if it goes weeks and things haven't taken place and certain activities haven't been done, well, like if you don't address it, well, then the only decision at some point is to fire somebody. And that's not good for your team members, not good for you, it impacts families in there. When being able to raise up and go, well, why aren't you doing this? And allow somebody to go, well, I'm not doing it because I don't see how this goes along with the outcomes. Well, that's a monumental thing for somebody to be able to admit. Now, that also, while I could be bothered by that, and I would be bothered by that if it took, months of that going on, The other side is at the leadership level, we could have identified it earlier, and it was our job to explain to the person we asked to do a specific activity how that was going to impact the outcome. And yes, we should have provided a safe space. They should have spoken up even if they didn't feel safe from it. But ultimately, it's on us for not connecting the vision and the with the outcome with the activity we asked for.
Thank you so much for that. Let's jump into real estate. Showcase IDX. That was your first venture in real estate, correct?
It was.
Give us an overview there.
So in the States, different than in other countries, there's a lot of, in every country, people search for a home with, I'm looking for a 3-bedroom home. In the States, we have about 600 different, basically, data sources. That there is a real estate standards organization, but real estate data is anything but standard. And so Showcase IDX was one of just three companies that would ingest all of those data sources and provide the search that would go on an individual real estate agent's website. So, hey, rather than competing with Zillow or Redfin, Showcase would allow that individual Keller Williams agent to have a website for their local community that their clients could actually use. And also those clients then wouldn't have their contact information sold or advertised out to other agents. But it was really good for the agents that use our product. And so that was the initial building. But it was also interesting. I never intended to come into real estate, nor did I ever intend to join. At that time, it was a small 6-person company. I don't join small companies. Like we talked about, I joined scaling companies. But I had a fraternity brother that reached out for a kind of a personal question that stumbled me into real estate all of a sudden.
So for the audience, tell me if I'm wrong. IDX is a standard, it's a data standard, which is based on XML, which allows for the parsing of data from the MLS system of each county or each state. Yeah. For each real estate agent to get that specific batch of real estate listings in the zip code and then parse it or put it via a WordPress plugin into their website. Do I get that correct?
Everything except for standard. It's standard on those local data feeds. And so I'm in Atlanta, Georgia. My house might actually be listed in two of those different data feeds, kind of the way you described. One is called First MLS and the other one is Georgia MLS. Their data feeds, it's standard within each of those, but the two data feeds themselves are going to be different. So the example I like to give is, hey, when a property goes for sale, of course, there's a date and a time that it goes for sale. But at one point in 2019, I spoke to the Real Estate Standards Organization, and we got the date and time that a new house went up on the market. It was in like 26 different formats. Because sometimes like there's, if we just do numbers, well, there's European format with the date up front to 2 digits, and then the month, and then the year, and then the states is different. Is the year in four digits or is it in two? Sometimes people gave it to us, and whether it was up front or in the middle, March would have been M-A-R. Others would have had the full name of March. And sometimes the time was part of that. So it's almost anything but standard for the people doing technology. So that real estate standards organization is trying to help with that because data's hard, but if it's when it becomes easier, now you can have more people doing innovation because it's not, you don't have to spend millions and millions of dollars trying to assimilate different data. Like this should just be, there's a date and time, the house went for sale.
But let me get that right, because the MLS is federal institution, so they should...
The MLSs are basically a private group of local agents. And so NAR in the States defined IDX, which basically says you all have to share information with others once you put it into this group. But the local, at least how I understand it, but like in FMLS is its own organization. Georgia MLS is another. Within still the state of Georgia, there's a small MLS just around Athens, Georgia, that's Athens MLS. And so the data is all, and they're kind of groups of agents that have agreed, my understanding anyways, and it may not be explained as completely well, is they've agreed to share the listing and data back and forth because it is good for consumers. if you're looking for a house, you don't want to have to go to an agent's place and pull up an old style. This would have been in a book. I want to be able to go online. The only way to do that is for the agents to share kind of that information or the brokers to share it.
Makes total sense. And then IDX did exactly this process of data cleansing, and basically creating like a common denominator on a federal level.
Yeah, well, on that individual level, so those agents, what you can only have access to whatever data you're a member of that MLS. And so if you join multiple MLSs, then you can have access to multiple data. So there's also that authorization for agents as well.
Interesting. And now I have a question for my company, Alocasa. So basically, if I accept the IDX structure schema on Alocasa, do I cover with that one the entire United States?
And I allow- there's not quite 600 different MLSs that cover the United States. There's maybe 250 that'll get you to about 90%. But I say that I work for the largest independently owned residential brokerage in America. And so we have like over 2 million listings for sale on our website, more than almost anyone else, at least the numbers that I've checked. And so I look at that. Well, I cover like 95% of all active listings in the United States right now. And I don't know, we have to see their numbers there, but we have hundreds and hundreds of MLSs. But sometimes when I add a new MLS, it might be 200 listings, maybe it's 2000. Now, those are still really important. Real estate is hyper local and hyper important. So if you're in a smaller MLS, like you want your house to be seen by others. But so like those MLSs, each one is important. So like FMLS here in Atlanta, I mean, they probably have 45,000 listings, I would bet, you know.
I understand. So basically, you have a huge team of data engineers making sure that it's all always syncing. It is always the data is definitely always up to date, and you're still accepting all the MLS schemas, because it can also be that the new head of MLS small town in
MLSs Georgetown do somewhere. Change a lot. They change standards. And even within, it's one thing if you're just that individual agent that's doing a website, or like at your company, you may need the data for different purposes. And so the same data that comes in from an MLS may be needed for these brokerage purposes, but my enterprise SEO team needs an entirely different set of data, timing of the data. I need it refreshed faster. I need them to normalize data or to do work on it. That is well beyond what's needed for the rest of the brokerage. And so every brokerage has to deal with that. Every company that comes in kind of has to go, well, what do I need it for? And then what am I going to use with it? I mean, it's very different closing a transaction or coordinated transaction than in our case, like I have 2 million listings, but there's way more to it than that. I'm trying to make sure, how do I get millions of people to find my site on, you know, on Google when they do a search? Well, that's a completely different need for the data. And so more data standards, more data changing.
Makes total sense. Thank you so much for all this clarifications. You sold this company to your current employer. Is that correct?
I was part of the small team that did. So there was only six of us when we sold the company. So
that's a nice feeling, isn't it? To make like a huge transaction and being part of a small team and not being in a huge corporation and being sold. How was that feeling?
It was a good feeling. I've been part of more than 60 acquisitions actually at this point. And so they're all different. They do feel a lot better when you're actually, they feel different when you're on the buying side, where I've been much more, or on the selling side. So this one felt pretty good. Having seen the numbers from when I joined, the numbers were substantially better. And then we grew it for about 3 years internal as well.
You mentioned buying versus selling side. So that was when EXP approached you, or was it a
seller? Primarily, I've done a lot of it as an investor, or I've been on the board or an advisor for companies. But when I was at NavTech and Here Technologies, we bought quite a few number of companies. Some big. We bought a company called Traffic.com. They were a big supplier of real-time traffic around the world. We bought a company out of Germany called MapSalute. That was kind of the back end We use them for creating routes and mapping and algorithms. So we bought them for about $20 or $24 million out of Germany. It was probably about 2006 or 2007. So we did a lot of acquisitions there. Some were kind of small, and some were kind of big, and they're all different. It always feels good to be done with them, and not just because, you know, sometimes cases you get a piece of the pie. In the case of Navtech, it was really good for investors on both sides of the table. But people don't realize so often when you're buying or selling a company, almost nobody does the work that they should have ahead of time to get the company prepared for acquisition. And so that's actually where I get brought in a lot, where people start thinking about that. And it's like, if you're already in discussions about an acquisition, sorry, I don't have time for that. You need to go talk to a consultant that just does M&A transactions or an investment bank. But if you're thinking about, hey, we want to get growth so that we could get bought in 3 years, well, that's a good time to start thinking about how do you package up? What documents do you have in place? Because what happens is, since nobody plans for that, there's so much work leading up to the closing, very similar to selling a house and buying a house. And so we need all these documents, and people want to see due diligence, and you're not bringing in an electrician, but you're bringing in an accountant to check things and a technology person. Well, all of that takes place, and whether that takes 60 days or 6 months, when it's finally signed, people just go, oh, it's kind of like, you know, if you're fighting with a partner, it's not that you should have broke up. And it's like the relief when sometimes people do break up, it's just because they're not fighting, and they should have just taken a breather and said, let's go to different sides of the house for a day or two.
That's a good one. I like that. EXP Realty, I've had already like three or four people on the show who are brokers who have been speaking highly of the entire concept, and also already gave an overview of this uniqueness of the digital brokerage firm. What is the secret sauce, except for maybe getting rid of the overhead expenses and being much more agile? Give us an overview there, please.
Well, I mean, I'm not an agent, and part of my job is not actually selling to agents. So there's a lot more information online. But my unique kind of approach to it is, like, I can't really speak to the business model as much as it's different than others. I hear that a lot. I think, at least myself, a lot of it does come down to the staff and things as well. So I look back at my teams over time, and like, it's not just from COVID. There's a lot of times the best people that I've ever worked with that's been a little bit of a blessing. I've always run teams on multiple continents as well. Time zones don't matter so much to me. I care about outcomes much more than I do somebody showing up to an office for things. But I'm able to tap into talent and hiring people that could not come into an office because of family situations, personal situations in there. Maybe they have a special needs child or then into elder care. I was early on at Showcase. We went through multiple years at the tail end with my mother where I was in elder care. If I did go into the Showcase office a good bit when Showcase had an office, but I could not have stayed at that company if they did not allow me to work remote taking care of my mom. And so I think that's a lot of it too, is not just can we kind of tap into people that from life perspectives may not be able to show up to an office, but we also acknowledge, like, we care about outcomes. I don't care about 35 or 50 hours from Michael being in a cube where people think that they know are people being productive. I get to see, because of the systems I have in place, are people actually reaching outcomes and doing things that should be reaching outcomes. I think that's really the secret sauce. And because we have that approach, and we focus everything I mentioned in servant leadership of, look, we're trying to figure out how do we serve agents. And some places people think about that and they go, well, we just want to do what the agents want. Well, sometimes what an agent says they want might be at conflict from another thing that they say. What they want is more clients. What they want is to serve their clients. Well, sometimes you might ask for something here and it conflicts over there. Well, at the core of it is we're trying to serve agents. We know the best way to do that sometimes is by serving consumers. And so it's kind of both and. And so I think that's some of the secret sauce that I kind of see what's different about eXp being a non-real estate person that's in real estate. I'm a technology person. So I kind of have a very different approach than I think a lot of people do that have 20 years or 30 years in real estate.
What is your daily activity? I understood that you do a lot of people management. You just mentioned actually for the first time that you're a technology person, but 90% of what I see is that you're a people person, and I believe that you just use the technology as an enabler to make to pull and get the best out of the people. How can I expect, or how can I imagine, like your average week, average month? What is it? If you have to give like a percentage of activities, what four tasks do you deal with?
I don't actually spend a lot of time managing people. I may spend a lot of time working alongside of people on my teams. A lot of I'd say the bulk of the time that I spent is actually what I would say I'm in the ditches digging, doing things that only Kurt can do. So one of the things that my team does is what's called enterprise SEO. How do we build a real estate website that generates much more traffic and ranks higher than Zillow, as an example? Well, that's not easy. There's no software you can buy off the shelf to do that. And so there's technology, there's enterprise and marketing software that I need, but it's also that I need the team to build, but it's also interfacing with my product manager. We have a product manager from Verizon Innovations. That's where he came from beforehand. His entire role is thinking about that consumer experience on the website and how does that interact. On the other side, I have another team member that he's just focused. He's 25 years in real estate. He's just focused on the tools that our team builds for real estate agents at eXp. We don't build tools for other people. And so some cases like that all overlaps. In some cases it doesn't. So I have to help them go through what problems are we trying to solve. Make sure that I know where they're at in building things, but then my team is responsible for training, onboarding, all of the SEO and organic growth stuff that I mentioned. But sometimes I'm doing masterminds. We have a new patent pending technology that eXp has talked about. And patent pending because the lawyers have believed that it's so new. There's no seven words I can just say that every agent in the world goes, oh, I understand what that is. When I say CRM, people go, maybe they'll go customer relationship management, but they at least know that's where my contacts go. So I can know, have I called them and who do I need to call next? I don't have that for this patent pending technology yet. And yet I have 1200 agents in an early access program. So I personally spend about 3 hours a week, literally running masterminds with them and prepping for it, for those early access people, seeing how they use it, giving feedback to the product team, and then going back and training. I mean, the only way you get to that hypergrowth we talked about is by sometimes doing unscalable things. And so on the really cool technology, that's a little bit easier to do. It's deep math, deep research. And I do all of that. And then I hand over what can be repeated processes to other people in my teams. On the training, I tend to do that very well and I enjoy it. And the numbers are going up very well, both from the patent pending stuff, and then little things like it should not be difficult in my mind to make a referral for one agent to another agent in the same brokerage. Hey, Michael, I got a lead there. They're in Portugal. Can I give you the lead? And then you go work the lead. But that was difficult. Even in the States, that was taking 30 to 45 minutes for one eXp agent to make the referral to another agent. It takes less than 45 seconds now with our technology. But you don't just build something and people use it. And so I'm literally explaining to people and walking them through and giving best practices and go, hey, Michael, if you rewrite your bio, here's how that'll work. And you'll come up for more referrals. And so we'll see tens and tens of thousands of referrals made with that tool. And it didn't even launch until March this year.
I see a huge interesting pattern in terms of early stage founder regarding observing clients, observing users, not asking them for features, but really understanding the problem, understanding also most of the problems they are labeling, and then putting something out, seeing how they behave, and then also understanding what is really like the pain and where they're potentially like spending the most money on. And this entire referral program, I think, hasn't been tackled or hasn't been solved by many companies yet. I had one lady, Grobecker, Teresa Grobecker from San Francisco on the show 2 years ago, twice already. She said, she sort of implied that she got screwed over by someone with a referral, because obviously you need to commission, and if you give something, and then she's, and I don't know, to be honest, where she is right now. I would like to have her on a show again. She said, I'm building a blockchain-based solution because I want to have everything basically like secured on the blockchain, that we know what's going on. Obviously, in a decentralized world, this is a very interesting use case. Here with EXP Realty, you have like the advantage of being an organization, so you can basically have inside the organization the proof. Do you see that there are many transactions being done? You just mentioned a number. Do you think like brokerage to brokerage is still a lot, and also on an international level?
It's a lot, even from brokerage to brokerage, from the agents that I talk to. I think a lot of times people do like to keep it in the family, so to speak, if they can. But that's, some cases, that's not always the best thing for the client. At the end of the day, most referrals only work when there's a closed transaction. So I think the most successful agents tend to be looking for, how do I find the best person to help my client that I'm handing off? But your other question about international, absolutely. I mean, we had our shareholder summit in May, and one of the questions I heard the most was, like, right now my referral tool only works in the US, where it will be rolling out globally. And so the one of the example I heard the most was this woman who runs Colombia for us came up, and she was like, when can I have this for here? And I tend to ask a lot of why questions. And so what she ended up telling me was, hey, there's a lot of people, specifically in Florida in the US, but throughout the US, that are buying land in Colombia, and a lot of people in Colombia that are buying condos for visiting in the States. I did not even realize that. And then she gave me probably like six more examples like that around the world in different places. And I was like, wow. And so I think there's a huge bit there internationally, but you run into these complexities that, whether it's blockchain or otherwise, technology can come and help solve grunt work. International referrals is hard. There's legalities in there. Which law applies? Do you do a form? Is it on blockchain? And so I kind of have the firm belief that technology should solve grunt work. And so in the States, if two agents are referring to making a referral, usually both managing brokers have to change. Well, did my managing broker change or not? If you're at a boutique, you probably know that. If you're at a big brand, you might not know that. Well, then that slows down that transaction. But that's something that I can know from data very well. And so you also mentioned about, like, on the startup side, it's really all about getting technology into people's hands and seeing how they use it and looking for often hidden assumptions. I find so often product teams, marketing teams, they roll stuff out and they think they're right. And then you watch people use it and they don't even see that new button that you added. And you go, yep, let's change it.
Yes, exactly. I can totally agree with that one. But I know your time is limited. I really appreciate your time. I learned a lot, and I'm very honored to have you on the show. You gave us a very interesting overview about your entire career, about how everything started from when you were 14 and created your two LLCs, to going down into this entire net weaving. I'm sorry, my English is not 100% fluent. You then also gave us a very interesting overview on the entire marketing side, on hustling, venture building, hyper growth, a very strong and very interesting topic, which I always myself like to talk about a lot. And you also gave us a very interesting overview of the entire tech industry in general, leadership, and how important being a good leader is, and how difficult it is, because we all think that we are the best leader and the others all suck. And having systems in place and pros in places which allow that is key, basically. you also then gave us a very interesting overview on the real estate, on IDX, and then finally showed us why EXP is increasing in market share and going so fast international, and not least or with a huge impact of you, obviously, of course. Good. Thank you so much. Once again, people can download your book, can have access to your book. I will we'll give that in the show notes. I will also put all the contact details of you in the show notes so that people can contact you and reach out to you. Is there anything you would like to mention which we haven't touched upon?
Not that we haven't touched on, but I appreciate you doing what you do for building an audience. I mean, I find it's one thing for me to work with people day in and day out, but the consistency of building a podcast and an audience and taking the time to schedule with people, like, I think most people that listen until you've been on one side or the other, as we both have, they don't realize how much goes into your side of like building an audience or something that they're listening to with every group or audience that you bring in.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I appreciate it. And I hope to have you back on the show very soon. And I send the best regards to Georgia.
All right.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
This video is brought to you by Holocaza. Our tool transforms independent local real estate agents to global real estate agents. Create your own profile for free and get contacted by international investors. Sign up with the link in the description.